Welcome to the Living Permaculture Show on Public Radio KDNK. I'm Stephanie Sison here with Jerome Osentowski. Today we are talking all about worms. On our show, we have Rhonda Sherman, who has been an Extension Waste Management Specialist with North Carolina State University since 1993. She is the founder and director of the Composting Learning Lab, which has 26 types of vermicomposting and composting bins. Her new book is The Worm Farmer's Handbook. So this is a guide to large-scale vermicomposting for farms, businesses, municipalities, schools, and institutions. Welcome to the show, Rhonda.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, well, thanks for joining us. We were so excited to get this copy of your book. Jerome himself is quite the worm farmer.
Wonderful.
Anyone who's been up to Crimpy, he does it mostly in the path. Well, he really has worm farms kind of everywhere in all of the greenhouses and all of the beds. But harvesting the castings and the worms from the pathways is one of the things that he's been doing up there for a while. Jerome, what do you have to say about your worm farming thus far?
Well, we shouldn't take up time to find out what she's up to, but I mentioned that we did just harvest 12 feet of the pathways, and I think we got 50 gallons of finished worm castings in 12 feet, and then we do, like I said, our whole food forest is a worm farm. All of our beds in the greenhouses are worm farms. Basically, we just plant into worm farms because we've been mulching for 20 years, and the worms continue to. But the book is fascinating. And I think it's like true alchemy when you think of you turning in, turning all this waste into worm gold. And right on the cover it says, you know, turn your food scraps, manure, yard waste, paper, and more, even paper dust into worm casting. So there's the opportunity to take something that's going to be thrown away or becomes a pollutant and to turn it into probably the most richest soil there is in the world, right?
Yes.
So yes. I'd love, Rhonda, just to kick us off for our listeners who maybe don't know what worm castings are or what the difference between regular compost and worm compost might be. What would be your intro statement to that?
I'm so glad you asked, because there's a huge difference between composting and vermicomposting. And thus the products, compost and vermicompost, are different, and it's important for people to realize that. So with composting, anybody who's done thermophilic composting, the goal is to get a nice hot pile, and so, you know, the microbial profile changes quite a bit during that process, and then you get this wonderful product that is very helpful to soils and plants. But with vermicompost, you're using microorganisms, but there's a wider variety and greater numbers, and then the material actually passes through a living animal, the worm, and comes out the other end. So you can see how they're totally different products. They have similar effects on soils and plants, but vermicompost has an extra oomph to it because of the numbers and varieties of microorganisms, and also because of humic acids and fulvic acids and plant growth hormones. And so if you were to manufacture compost, you might sell it for $30 to $35 per cubic yard. But with vermicompost, you could sell the same quantity, a cubic yard, for between $200 and $1,800. So big difference there.
And why is that? Is it because it's more potent? It has more of the microbial life?
Right. The things I said, that it has more microbes and it has the plant growth hormones and the fulvic acids and humic acids. So it just has more going on with it, and higher nutrient levels and, you know, more readily available to plants. So you can see differences. There are so many scientific experiments have been done, seeing the effect of vermicompost on plants and also comparing it to regular compost. And vermicompost always outcompetes regular compost.
And Rhonda, it has such a pest control quality to it, too. It's a,
yes.
Why don't
yes.
you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah. I talk about that in the book, that that pests, for vermicompost, if plants are planted in vermicompost or if vermicompost tea is sprayed on plants or on the soil, or even if the seeds are soaked in vermicompost tea for an hour before planting, then it can suppress plant diseases and suppress attacks by arthropods, insects, and also parasitic nematodes. So there's much documented about that.
And so is it doing that in a direct way or in combination in relationship to just providing the plant with so much nutrients that it's so much more healthy that it's resistant to these infections as well?
Yeah, there are actually a lot of mechanisms going on, but it does make the plant healthier, and there are just, you know, it really depends. We don't have time to go into it, but there are just many mechanisms going on that can repel. Does that mean that all vermicompost will completely knock out pest attacks and diseases? No. Vermicompost, it depends on what feedstocks you use, how you actually do the vermicomposting, so many factors. So you end up with different vermicomposts, and then plants respond differently. So some plants may love vermicompost that's made from cow manure, for example, whereas other plants respond better to vermicompost made from food waste.
And so this book, you were talking about the price differences between compost and vermicompost. It really is geared towards this potential business owners as opposed to just home scale farms, which I found fascinating because there's a lot of information out there about worm farming in your house, but not necessarily so much geared toward the business side of it. And that was, it seemed like your book was very, very rich with that information.
Yeah, and that's why I wrote it. And actually, Chelsea Green Publishing approached me and said, we see that small-scale vermicomposting, that there are books out there about that, and there have been for a few decades, and, you know, excellent books. But there just weren't books about mid- to large-scale vermicomposting. And that's something I've specialized in for the past 25 years. And I've held 19 annual vermiculture conferences on mid to large scale vermicomposting, and it's been attended by people from around the world, from 34 different countries, because it's the only thing on mid to large scale vermicomposting. So in my book, I did not talk about small scale vermicomposting at all, because like I said, it's been covered in other excellent books. But this one, it's for people who want to get into it commercially, but also just do it on a larger scale. And so, for example, a school that wants to take all of their cafeteria food waste and vermicompost it, they can do that by following what I've talked about in the book. And I also have several profiles of different businesses and different vermicomposting operations, including schools and universities and prisons and hospitals, all sorts of places that are doing vermicomposting on a larger scale.
And then what are the larger organizations, say if they're not in business, a school or prisons or what have you, what are they doing with all the castings?
Oh, so you mean, okay, so if they're not selling the castings?
Right, mm-hmm.
They're either using it on the grounds, you know, because it's needed at schools. So many schools nowadays have gardens, and so they're using it to grow food? Are you using it to replace the fertilizers and pesticides that have been used on the school grounds?
Right, like on the lawns and the football fields and things like that?
Yes.
Excellent. And yep. for an average size school, how big does a operation have to look like to consume a worm farm to consume the waste from a cafeteria on average? Is this like an acre of space, or can they build them very efficiently?
That's just it. I mean, no, it's not an acre of space, and it depends. There is no average, because it really depends on the number of
students, people, and food.
The number of people consuming food, because it's done in prisons and hospitals and all over the place, and it also depends on what waste reduction components they have in place to try to reduce the amount of waste. So, you know, you see how there's a big difference between a school that doesn't worry about their waste and others that really try to trim the amount of waste that's created. So, and then vermicomposting, what's really important to remember is that you don't want it to heat up. So remember how I said with composting, you want it to heat up, but with vermicomposting, you don't, because that would kill the worms. So it needs to be a shallow, horizontal process. So, you know, that can take up some room. But your worm windrows, depending on the materials and how they've been prepared, you're probably going to want it to be less than 3 feet tall.
And so for our listeners maybe who are thinking about doing some worm bins at home, and not that that's what your book was about, but I'm sure you have a lot of information for those listeners, are the towers or the regular bins, or what do we feed them? Is it just coffee and tea and paper, or what can we not put in these bins? How are we most effective for our home gardens raising worms, and what are the best systems that you've seen in your experience?
Well, people who want to do small scale, just take their kitchen waste. I have a free publication called Worms Can Recycle Your Garbage. It's on my website, which is composting.ncsu.edu. And so it's a very concise publication that tells how to set up and maintain a worm bin. And so it talks about the types of foods that are acceptable and then the foods that shouldn't be added to a home worm bin. So
people can get that there.
Well, Rhonda, I use 15-gallon nursery pots during the wintertime to do small-scale worm farming. And then I can sell those worms. I can sell worms out of there at a farmer's market or at a nursery sale. And so I just take a 15-gallon nursery pot, three of them, let's say, and sheet mulch, put in some rotten hay or straw, and then put in some in the kitchen bucket and maybe some rabbit manure and some leaves, and then maybe do that twice and then top it off with leaves and add worms in there. And I stack those three high. And I usually put them in the greenhouse in the wintertime. You can do it outside. And, in a month and a half, you come back, you might have to dump them a couple of times, but you've got that whole 15-gallon bucket completely digested. And so that's a really good, backyard scale. Or you can just do, like you said in the book, a triangular pile up against a corner somewhere or up against a couple of pallets and just throw some leaves and rotten manure in there and then bury your kitchen garbage. Well, again, that's the problem with bears and raccoons around here. But that's what I used to do. Is also, I used to do it in my straw yard. And I'm sure you have some other small scale approaches on your website.
Yeah. So I differentiate between small scale, medium scale, and large scale, and so. You know, small scale is basically, anybody, like somebody living in an apartment or living in a home and they just want to take their kitchen scraps and coffee grounds and vermicompost it. So you might end up with a 14-gallon tote bin, you know, that kind of thing. And so, but then medium scale would be somebody who, like you mentioned, did you mention rabbit manure?
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, people who have rabbits or goats or sheep or alpacas or cows or, you know, different types of livestock, that would be more of a medium scale where you'd want a little larger system, you know. And then large scale would be, you know, where you could get into really huge operations, you know. I profiled vermicomposting operations from around the world, and, you know, some are on 200 acres, some are on more than that, you know. So it can be done on a really huge scale with billions of earthworms.
Yeah.
So I'm going to jump in there really quick. You are listening to the Living Permaculture Show on Public Radio KDNK. We are talking everything worms and worm castings with Rhonda Sherman. So we can get back in. Jerome, you had a question?
Well, there's you can do windrowing for manures, but small or large scale, medium scale windrowing on a farm. And that's at least in the summer here, you could digest all your manures in a shallow, long linear pile and introduce the worms in there and turn it a couple of times, and you would have worm castings, wouldn't you?
Yeah, except for the turning part. But yes, people do vermicomposting in windrows. Yeah, it works really well. All you do is keep layering on, you know, thin layers of the feedstock. And so you never turn it. You just, because the worms move upward to the food. So you just apply a thin layer on top, wait till they've consumed it, and then you add another thin layer. So, you know, one of the places I profiled was called The Worm Farm in Durham, California, and they have a mile and a half of windrows on their 40-acre farm, and they're using dairy manure to feed the worms.
Right. That's a great idea. And there's some other examples, and you've been to Cuba. I've been there a couple of times and saw some of their worm farming techniques, mostly in shade houses with concrete block beds, really long beds, and they were very effective in generating all of the soil nutrients for their vegetable and production in the urban areas of Cuba with worm farms.
Yes, and I did include a description of a worm farm in Cuba along with a photo. I didn't actually go there, but anyway, I did want to highlight the fact that, you know, because of the Cold War and embargoes, that Cuba had to get resourceful very quickly. They were like, okay, it looks like we have to grow our own food. And so last I knew, there were 174 worm farms in Cuba because they realized the importance of turning their waste into black gold to increase the vitality of their soils and grow more food. So it's an excellent example. But people in 111 countries have contacted me, and it's just been wonderful to see how many people are taking what's considered waste by many and turning it into something valuable.
Yeah, I remember one farm I visited a couple of times in Cuba that they were doing five crops of salad greens in their garden with worm casting. So every 2 months they basically would harvest another, you know, that's the only way you could do that is to amp it up with this high potency fertilizer.
Rhonda, you have this example in your book of the turnip experiment. Can you talk a little bit about that in relation to plant growth and what you have seen in these studies?
Well, I love that photo because it's a real wow.
It is, you know? A really wow photo. You're like, oh my God, it's a giant turnip.
Yes. So there's a color photo in the book, and I love to show it on screens, you know, a big screen projected on a screen, and, you know, it's a knock-your-socks-off photo. And basically, we had a grant And we were looking at water quality from runoff, and so we weren't examining the effect of vermicompost on plant growth, but we couldn't help but notice the effect it was having on the plants. So we had randomized plots over a year and a half. So we had three different seasons and actually three different locations. And we made sure that all of the plots had equal amounts of nitrogen. That's really important to realize, because you would look at, when you see the giant turnips, you think, oh, it must have more nitrogen, but they don't. All three turnips that you see have the same amount of nitrogen. So the only difference is that the turnip on the left, which is a small, regular-sized turnip, had zero vermicompost. And the big, the huge turnip next to it that has, you know, this really long, robust root system and much bigger turnip itself, and then huge turnip greens, that had 10% by volume vermicompost, which is really amazing. So we literally removed all of the soil from the plot that would get 10%, and we removed it 6 inches deep. And then we took 10% of it out and mixed, and then added 10% by volume vermicompost and mixed it in. And then we reapplied it to the plot. And then you see the turnip on the right, and, you know, it's just... huge.
He's huge and beautiful.
Yes. And it only had 20% by volume vermicompost added. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's just so remarkable to see that just a little bit goes a long way. And if you remember at the beginning of our conversation, I was saying that vermicompost sells for between $200 and $1,800 per cubic yard. So the good news is that you need just a really small quantities of vermicompost to have this amazing effect on the growth of plants. So you can see they're just healthier, just much better developed root systems. And then we didn't test them for disease or pest resistance. Those are totally different, you know, scientific activities that you would conduct, but I'm sure they probably have some pest and disease resistance properties as well.
I would say if they're that healthy.
Rhonda, before we're going to be running out of time, I wanted to talk a little bit about pesticide contamination and in the food chain that worms are going to be eating, and you know that is a problem with finding some mulches and different materials that are contaminated with pesticides, and they'll kill the worms or slow the whole composting process down, right?
No, it won't necessarily kill the worms. Worms are used to remediate contaminated soils. So, you know, soils that are contaminated with petroleum and heavy metals, cadmium, all sorts of toxic compounds, studies have been done around the world, and actual remediation projects using worms.
They work like microbes then, right?
Sort yeah, of. Right. And the worm, so, you know, you just have this huge number of microbes, and then the worms are eating the microbes and any small particles. And what they're finding is that the toxic compounds and pathogens tend to lodge inside the earthworms and not come out the other end. So studies have been done where, for example, known numbers of certain types of pathogens are introduced to the worms, and then they test the worm castings, their manure, and they find that just very small amounts of the pathogens actually come out the other end of the worm. So that's really good news in terms of reducing toxicity and heavy metals and pathogens.
Yeah, because the composting process alone doesn't kill certain herbicides. It could take 2 to 3 years to compost it out, even at higher temperatures. So The worms are really the savior here, then.
So on the note of the worms being the savior, we are running out of time. And Rhonda, I'd love for you to give your information again.
Herbicides are a different thing, and I do caution people about persistent herbicides.
Yeah, and this,
you can see an alert on my website about it, and I talk about it in the book.
That you do go into that quite a bit in the book, as well as a ton of other really amazing and useful information, as well as like the physiology of worms and how many different varieties of earthworms there are. It's really an interesting subject. I would love in our last 30 seconds for you to give your contact information one more time.
Okay, so go to my website. It's just composting.ncsu.edu. So the NCSU is for North Carolina State University.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Rhonda. It was great to have you on, and we will talk to everyone again next month.
Yeah,
this was the Living Permaculture Show on Public Radio KDNK.